You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
If you remember last week, we were reading this passage in Matthew chapter 19, where a group of Pharisees come up to Jesus, and they ask him about a question about divorce is really how this whole conversation starts. They tried to trap Jesus with this question: should a man be allowed to divorce his wife for just any reason? They're very obsessed with what are the reasons that I'm allowed to get divorced from my wife. Only the husband could initiate a divorce back at this time. Jesus comes back at them. He says, haven't you read the scriptures? They record that from the beginning God made them male and female. So he made them separate. And yet he says, this explains why a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. Again, since they are no longer two but one, let no one split apart what God has joined together. So the emphasis here is on the permanent oneness that comes through a sexual relationship and a marriage relationship. And so they come back at him. They say, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away if God is all into this oneness thing? Why did he tell us to get divorced? And Jesus says, actually, for one, he didn't command anyone to get divorced. He permitted it. And he said, the reason was not because your wife is so screwed up. The reason is because of your hardness of heart. Because marriage is revealing much deeper problems about you. And that's why, you know, much later, way after God's original design for sex and marriage, he did allow for the one to become two again. But he says, from the beginning, it has not been this way. And so we see a couple things from this passage. Last week we talked at length about this whole idea. What does it mean for the two to become one? What is the Bible's view of sexuality? We saw that there is a way that seems right to human beings, but in the end it leads to death. And that, as counterintuitive as it might be, the only way to go is God's way when it comes to sex. God's the one that designed it. God wants us to have maximally awesome sex, and so he's shown us how it works. But, you know, what's clear here is that God wants you to have a successful marriage. This is God's will. You know, he didn't design marriage in such a way that no one could succeed at it. And marriage will expose what Jesus calls your hardness of heart in a major way. As one author put it, you know, marriage never fails. It's the people that fail. Marriage just exposes that. And this is so often the case. Well, you know, we'll get into marriage, we'll feel like everything's fine, my relationships are fine, my relationship with my significant other is fine. We get into marriage, and all of a sudden, we start to see all these problems start coming out. We feel like my spouse has changed. What's wrong with him? What's wrong with her? They've got all these problems with me. I'm the same person I always was. They're the one that have changed. They're the reason why this isn't working out. And so that's why we see so many marriages crumbling. And Jesus says it's not the other person's fault. Primarily, your focus needs to be on you and your fault in this matter. And so tonight, what we're going to talk about, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about how to prepare for marriage, what we can do now. The vast majority of us here in this room are single. And so we're going to talk about, is there anything we can do now in order to be ready for our future marriage? We're also going to talk a little bit about how to succeed within marriage. And these principles, as we saw last week, these principles are also applicable in a lot of our normal relationships that we have. This does not exclusively apply to a marriage relationship. So I think whether we're married or single, I think we'll see real relevant application for this whole teaching. So let's talk about preparing for marriage. And we want to look at what the construct that our culture has basically inherited. It's the dating model of selecting a spouse. And, it hasn't always been this way. Back in Jesus' time, your parents had you paired up with somebody and oftentimes married by the time you were 13 or 14 years old. So, you know, those of us that are out of high school would be married for 5 or 6 years by now, if that was the case. And, in typical dating, the way we relate to one another, you can kind of think of it like this. We talked about this last week. This is a typical dating relationship that's not centered in God. And so you've got me and you've got you, and we're together, and both of us, we're trying to get our needs met by the other person. And we might have some sort of synergy where we both are basically happy and content in this relationship, but there might get to a point where I feel like you're not meeting my needs enough, you might feel the same way about me, and conflict begins to arise. Oftentimes this kind of degenerates into some sort of a power play where the one partner is in control and calls the shots, and the other one is kind of led around by that partner. And you know, if you think about the different ways that we can relate to one another, the physical, the personal, and the spiritual, typical dating relationships usually end up looking something like this. From the very beginning, the attraction is often physical. And you know, you might go out once, twice, maybe a third time. But from the very beginning of the relationship, you guys are all over each other. You're hoping to go all the way, if not all the way, pretty close to all the way. Even a lot of Christians, unfortunately, approach dating this way. And so we kind of, you know, and you know, it's a rush, it's exciting. And then, you know, it's easy. The physical part is easy, it feels good, there's an immediate payoff. Okay, you don't have to know someone very well, and this can be a complete stranger to get some good feelings physically off of this other person. There's also an immense personal element that each of us has, where we're talking about our feelings, about our emotions, our likes, our dreams, where we're just, you know, relating, conversing about various topics of interest, books we're reading, politics, things that I'm into, where I came from, my background, all of those sorts of things. That's more difficult than the physical. It takes a little bit more effort and ability and skill, and yet it still can feel really good. You know, sitting there across from one another, cooing at one another, you know, you're sharing this deep part of your life and you've just got such a rush. It's like this drug that's coursing through your veins. Or, you know, they're talking and you're just sitting there thinking about how cute he is or how cute she is. And, you know, it doesn't even matter what they're saying. They could be reading the phone book to you. And, you know, I just can't believe what a beautiful voice she has and her hair. And but the personal, you know, the relating to one another and a whole variety of aspects, it's more difficult. It still feels good. Hopefully you're, you know, in a typical dating relationship, you get some of this going, but always with the physical part there. The spiritual aspect of a relationship, a typical dating couple might not even have a category for this. This can be very difficult, uncomfortable. But it's also essential for an other-centered relationship. If we're going to have the kind of relationship that we were talking about last week, one that's centered in God, there's got to be a spiritual component. There's got to be a pretty significant spiritual component, and we've got to put a lot of effort into it because of these three, it's the hardest one. What you see in dating is that an early jump into the physical, because it feels so good, tends to short-circuit more difficult types of investment. It's like we could either try to work out this conflict or we could hop in bed together. And, you know, a lot of times the choice is pretty easy, especially since, you know, the more you talk about trying to work the conflict out, the worse things seem to get. Seems like we're just wasting our time, and why don't we just go this route instead? Another thing that you'll see, too, is that in a relationship, as a relationship starts to deteriorate, as the conflict perhaps starts to increase, as the couple seems to resent one another more and more, what you'll find is that the level of relating will slowly be reduced to the lowest common denominator. And, you know, more and more you'll be turning to the physical to try to solve real problems in the relationship. And all that's doing is it's putting a Band-Aid over it and it's, you know, it's not the way to go, but it feels easy, feels good. So that's a typical dating relationship. But last week, we also presented a different model, and under this model, it's not just me and you in this dating relationship, but this is a relationship that is centered in God. This is where both of us have a relationship with God. Both of us have, hopefully, even before we get into this relationship, an exciting spiritual life. And then as we come together in a dating relationship, both of us are real interested in having God be a part of this relationship. And this really involves relating to one another under two very different types of love. You know, the Greek language has several different words for love. And there's one word called eros that the biblical authors pretty much stayed away from. Eros would be often what we think of as love today. It's an intense feeling that strikes you. You know, again, like it feels like a drug coursing through your veins. It feels amazing. It's like you can't think of anything else except for this incredible feeling that you're having. It feels really good. you know, it makes your heart race. It's just really exciting. It's like an adrenaline rush, except sustained. You know, the idea of love at first sight, the idea that I have a soulmate out there, and if I just, you know, meet my soulmate and our eyes meet, and we know we're going to be together forever. You know, some people believe in this this fairy tale view of love, something that just happens to me, something where I just need to find the right person that makes me feel the right way. And, you know, eros can be a little bit depressing when viewed from one perspective because you feel pretty helpless. You know, you just kind of hope that you feel that way. And if the feelings go away, this is why maybe we're so, many of us are so terrified of some sort of a commitment like marriage, is because if the feelings go away, then what am I left with? How do I get those feelings to come back again? What if they never come back again? You feel totally powerless, like that's the end of the relationship. And so relationships are really, it's as long as the eros is still flowing through my veins, then I'm in this relationship. And if not, I need to go find some other way to feel good. On the other hand, though, the word agape, also a Greek word, it was actually relatively uncommon at the time when the New Testament was written. And the New Testament writers actually keyed in on this word partly because the connotations associated with eros, love, which is where we get like our word erotic, the connotations associated with that were not the kind of love that they were talking about. You know, agape, this is the kind of love that's used to describe God's love. And, you know, it's a choice to give to another regardless of what I get back. It's a choice to give to the other person regardless of what I'm getting in return from them. And so, you know, whereas agape love may go in and out of eros, you know, it may have the feelings there one moment, the feelings could be totally gone the next. I don't know about you guys, but my feelings are pretty fickle. They can be here and gone instantaneously. This choice is not something that happens to me mysteriously, like love at first sight, but it's something I decide that I'm going to do. And that's the kind of love that a relationship that's based in God needs to have. Because, you know, if this is a choice to give, what we need to do is we need to first encounter the love of God. And that's why this vertical dimension is so important, because as we experience the love of God, what that's going to do is that's going to give us a solid foundation to give to one another. And even if the other person isn't necessarily meeting my needs right now or hasn't for a while, what I know is my needs are met by God because God has decided to give to me. And so I, in turn, can choose to give to this other person. And so we want to think about this same approach, and we want to think about what would some aspects of an agape relationship be when it comes to dating. Okay, first of all, the direction's totally different. You know, instead of starting with the physical right out of the gates, and then maybe working up to the personal and perhaps the spiritual, if we ever get around to it. Instead, an agape relationship, dating under an agape model, is going to start with the spiritual. So let's think about each of these different aspects of relating. You know, under agape, God is first. God is first in my life overall. Like Jesus said earlier in this book of Matthew, seek first his kingdom, his righteousness, all these other things will be added unto you. So God is also going to be first in my dating relationship. I'm putting him first. Well, under the eros model, we put ourselves first. And, you know, that's not compatible with the agape models. What do we need? What do we want? What do we feel like doing? You know, it's feeling. It's intensely feelings-based. You know, under the spiritual model, we're going to try to pray together. We're going to try to read the Bible together. This sounds totally weird if you've never been in a relationship like this. The thought that I might pick up a girl to go on a date and, you know, maybe at the beginning of the night I would ask her if she wants to pray. Or maybe at the end of the night asking her, would you like to pray as I drop her off? That could feel pretty uncomfortable to do that. That could feel totally weird. And I tell you what, guys, chicks are into this sort of thing. But that's not why we do it, of course. But it is consistent with this spiritual, you know, the spiritual aspect of relating under an agape relationship. We're trying to say, okay, the two of us are here, and we also both, God's a real important part of our lives, so maybe we should talk to him as well. And it introduces this vertical dimension that really changes, can change the tone of the evening. We may read the Bible together. We might talk about things we're reading in the Word. Again, this is weird to somebody who's never tried this before, but if you're actually excited about something you've been reading, or maybe you're studying to teach the Bible, and you're just coming across some really awesome truths, or maybe even something you're confused about, and you start talking about this with this guy or this girl that you're out with, that's really cool if they're also into that as well. If they're a spiritual person, that's going to be something that's real exciting to them. That's something they prioritized in their life. We may use our dating time to serve other people. Instead of, you know, this is dating time, everyone else is set to the side, we might say, you know, maybe we're going to spend some time together on Saturday evening, that's date night, and we're going to spend part of it to, you know, serve someone else in whatever way. Maybe it's just going to a function that our home church is doing, and going there and trying to talk with other people, instead of go there and then form our own little, you know, exclusive dyad. We're going to go, we're going to talk to other people, we're touching base. We might go away and then have a conversation about some of the talks we have with people. Under the Eros model, though, everyone else is a third wheel. Okay, it's just me and you. And so, I don't know if you've ever been in a relationship like I have where, you know, you're sitting there talking with your boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, maybe after a meeting like this, and somebody comes up and they're like, look, I'm really sorry, I just got a quick question for you, I'll be out of here real quick. I remember sitting there with my girlfriend one time, and somebody came up and just started apologizing profusely for interrupting us, and I thought to myself, I think we're giving off the wrong vibe here. I think there's a weird exclusiveness here that I don't want to be part of this relationship. Everybody else, though, is a third wheel. You know, it's like you start dating, all of your friends disappear because my life is being sucked from this other person. That's where I'm getting all of my good feelings, and I'm doing as much as I can to stoke the fire of Eros, to keep it burning. Because, you know, if Eros is all you got, you know, that's a fire with no fuel. That's a fire that is constantly going out, and you got to keep throwing more and more fuel onto that fire, and oftentimes regretting it as you do. No thought is put into how to use the relationship to serve other people. It's a me-first relationship. And if I got to give to my boyfriend or girlfriend to get something, that's fine. But as far as the both of us sacrificing to give to other people, that's just out of the question. Let's think about the personal aspect. How would that look under an agape versus an eros model? Well, under an agape model, we're going to understand each other's weaknesses. I'm going to have an awareness of this person's strengths and weaknesses, which is different than under the eros model, where I know and I exploit the other's strengths and weaknesses. I know what I need to do to get what I want from this person. And so I might pull whatever tactic I need to pull, and I'm using my intimate knowledge of this person to get what I want from them, to manipulate them. Under the agape model, you know, with knowledge of this, I might encourage the person, I might even admonish the person, you know, a mild rebuke, maybe even a little stronger rebuke, and because I'm trying to help this other person be all that they can be. I'll tell you what, you know, it's one thing to have a roommate tell you, I feel hurt when you do this. It's totally different to have your boyfriend or your girlfriend say, I feel hurt when you do this. They both might be saying the same thing, and yet for some reason, people are much more inclined to listen to the boyfriend or the girlfriend that tells them how they're negatively affected. They're so eager to change, whereas the roommate just has some sort of an attitude problem. Under the Eros model, though, I'm flattering and attacking the other person. It's not encouragement. It's all with strings attached. It's all with some sort of an angle for me to spin this back to me and to try to increase that feeling. We've got a vision for their development. You know, I'm thinking to myself, how can I make this person a better spouse for somebody else someday? You know, if this person married a good friend of mine, would I be happy that I left them a better, a more spiritual, a better person than when they started dating me? Or are they going to be a wreck? Are they going to be in therapy for several years undoing the damage that I've done in this dating relationship? You know, under Eros, it's I have a plan for how I can get what I want. I have a vision for me and getting from this person, not a vision for them and how I can make them all they can be. And then, of course, in the physical realm, we kind of talked about some of this last week, but let's just sketch this out. You know, under the agape model, we're patient. We can wait. The Eros model, we can't wait. I got to have it, and I got to have it now, baby. The agape model is going to be conservative. They might even hold back a little bit. Maybe we could go even a little further, but I'm going to be conservative because I don't want to, you know, even kind of dance right there on the edge of what's okay to do. Because I know if I do this, then I want to do that. And that's not okay. And so I'm going to stay back here. The Eros model, we're just trying to stoke that fire as hot as we can get it. The agape model, there's a real wisdom approach to the dating relationship. Whereas the Eros model, appetite is the driving force. The agape model is self-controlled. The Eros model says, I just take whatever, we both take whatever we want from each other. We both are going to use one another, and we basically are fine with that. And, you know, the agape model, it's never taking. It's always doing what's better for the other person. So this is the ideal. This is an agape relationship, and, you know, this really should characterize all of our relationships, but we're thinking here about how this would apply then to a dating relationship. You know, the key here is balance in these areas. The key here is balance in these different areas that we can relate to the whole, relate to the person. You know, if you think about, let's think about an immature relationship, a spiritually immature relationship. You get two spiritually immature, selfish people together, and it's probably going to look something like this. Very heavy investment in the physical. And that's been happening from the very beginning. You're going to have some investment in the personal. The spiritual, if it's even there at all, is going to be very minimal. It's kind of hard to pray together after you've had a real, you know, rousing groping session. It's hard when you feel an incredible sense of guilt and shame when you know you've just used each other and totally lost respect for the other person because they let you use them. It's hard to then sit, you know, turn around and pray to God. It's hard to be that excited about the Bible because you basically, your hypocrisy is just overwhelming the relationship. On the other hand, a spiritually mature relationship is going to look something more like this. There's a very heavy investment in the spiritual, and really, as far as the spirituality piece goes, there's no limit to how far you can go. You can kind of, you've got free rein in this area to try to help develop the other person spiritually, and really it's trying to help each other grow in your relationship with God. The personal, you know, there are going to be some areas that you hold back. You don't want to just, you know, we're not just letting everything fly when it comes to the personal. We're slowly letting it grow as the commitment level increases. And the physical is going to be definitely, we're going to try and put constraints on that. We're going to try to keep that from getting out of control, partly because we know how quickly the physical can balloon. And as the commitment level rises, the personal and physical aspect should increase. So, you know, as your relationship moves on, you know, maybe this couple is moving into engagement, where they're much more committed to one another. You know, your physical is going to increase. The personal aspect of sharing is going to increase. You know, I would say, if for an engaged couple, I'm not sure there'd be any limit to the personal aspect of the relationship either. What you can share with each other. And, you know, as far as the personal goes, that can be pretty much like marriage, I think. From my experience, the physical tends to move forward on its own. You never, in a dating relationship, you never have to sit down and say, all right, we're going to have to really exert effort here to try to push this relationship forward in the physical realm. Married relationships, actually, surprisingly, can be a different story. It's kind of weird how this works. The selfishness in dating that makes you want to just go all systems go for the physical actually can impede your desire to be physically intimate in marriage. As one friend of mine put it, who used to do student work and then did adult ministry for a while, she said, it's weird. In student ministry, we spend our time trying to keep the couples from having sex. And in adult ministry, we spend our time trying to get the couples to have sex. It's kind of hard to understand how that works, but the physical does tend to move forward on its own. And what that means is that wise dating couples are going to take extra precautions to practice self-control. This is the route of wisdom. For example, is a wise dating couple going to go and watch movies up at my parents' place because they're out of town this weekend? That's a good way to get in trouble right there. It's just me and you. No one else even has a key to this house. And we're snuggled up here on the couch in the basement with the lights out. Man, you know, you're messing with stuff that is pretty powerful going on inside each of you. Date nights going until 3 in the morning. I tell you what, when I was dating my wife, nothing good ever happened past about 1 in the morning, if that late. Your defenses are down, you're tired, other people are going to bed. It's the conditions are ripe for getting into sin. The camping trip we're planning on going together, just me and my girlfriend and this other non-Christian couple, the long trip home for the weekend, it's not technically sin to do something like that, but is it really the course of wisdom to get into that sort of a thing? Or this one here, simulating sex with our clothes on. it's like, okay, I mean, the clothes are technically on. But at the same time, again, you know, you're awakening deep desires in each one of you, where if you go a certain distance, you may want to just go all the way. It's like that scene in the first Lord of the Rings where they go down through the mines and they awaken that, like, fire demon that starts coming out to them, the Balrog. Man, you do not want to awake the Balrog. All right, so as we're preparing for marriage, we're learning how to love sacrificially. We're learning how to build an agape relationship, how to love this whole person in a sacrificial way, not doing what feels good to me, but doing what's best for that other person. As you can imagine, that's going to take a certain amount of maturity to even be able to do something like that. Our own appetites, our own desires can get out of control here. So another question we got to ask is, how do I know when I'm ready to take on something like marriage? And the answer is, from one perspective, you'll never be fully ready for marriage. That's one of the cool things about marriage is however ready you feel like you are going into it, you get there and you realize, I've got some serious deficiencies, things I never even knew were problems, ways that I hurt people, and your marriage is going to bring that out. And what's cool is a marriage that continually grows for the rest of your life is also going to continue to force you, to keep you on your toes, to grow spiritually for the rest of your life, to where there's never a point where you can plateau, but as you become more and more like Christ, you can also grow closer and closer to one another. However, here are some questions you can ask yourself to think through. How might I do in marriage? And these give us some things to work on for now while we're single. For one, have I learned to practice sexual self-control? How's my porno problem? Marriage will not make your porno problem go away, sorry to tell you. It may make it worse. Have I learned sexual self-control in our dating relationship? Or, maybe it's not that, but maybe it's, extreme flirting with everybody that I see, trying to get my good feelings off of members of the opposite sex. That's going to be real destructive in marriage when you get tired of your spouse and you want to go on to something new. Have I demonstrated the ability to build successful relationships? We talked about this a little bit last week, but I can't emphasize how important this is. Have I learned to love members of the same sex? Not, how do I love members of the opposite sex? Because that feels really good. You don't get that incredibly awesome rush talking to your roommate as you do talking to a pretty girl. So have I learned how to love other people in ways that they actually feel loved? Are other people actually saying, I feel loved by you? I really appreciate our relationship. Have I developed a ministry? This is kind of an interesting point here. Have I learned how to give to other people in a sustained and consistent way? Where, each week I'm showing up and I'm giving to this person, to this group, serving in some way or another. Again, it's not intuitive that this would have a positive impact on my marriage, but that's something we discovered in this fellowship probably 20 or 30 years ago, where it was basically this kind of this revival among high school and college students. People started getting married, and marriage after marriage started to fail. And so they launched this exhaustive marriage study, and the single greatest factor that they found on the marriages that succeeded was not time, how long they'd been a Christian. It was not a number of other factors as well that they might have guessed. But it was this one right here. Has this person learned to give to another in a regular and consistent way without expecting anything back? You know, the skills to build a successful, if you've ever had like a discipling relationship, the skills to successfully do that are also kind of similar to the skills required to have a healthy marriage. Can I hold a job? Again, if I wake up in the morning and they're just like, I just don't feel like going into work, my job sucks. What is that saying? I just want to do what feels good. And what are you going to do when you wake up in the morning and you look across at your spouse and you're like, I don't feel like trying in this marriage. I'm not getting anything out of it. If you're always hopping from job to job versus if you're a good worker, that can be a positive indicator for marriage. Emotional stability. Are my emotions all over the place? Have I learned how to be content? Have I learned how to have peace no matter what my circumstances are? Or am I dependent on my circumstances to get that? These are all, you know, part of what these all indicate is they indicate a real deep, healthy relationship with God. And he's the one that enables you to do all these other things. Can I be content while single? You got some people where unless they have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, they're not happy. They even see their current relationship starting to go down and they start lining up somebody else that they're going to date as soon as this one ends. Am I dependent on a significant other in order to be happy? Or can I be happy and single? The question that answers is, am I primarily dependent on my significant other or on God for my happiness? How well do I manage my finances? My spending is often an indication of character. Am I always overspending? Am I always, spending myself into debt? That could be a factor in marriage. Finance is one of the greatest areas of conflict, especially in newly married couples. And age is also a consideration here. It has been noted that people that get married before they're like 20 or 21 have a much higher rate of marriage failure. And so I think it is a consideration, you know, if you're like sitting here and you're 16, I would probably recommend waiting a little bit on marriage. But I don't think it's important to some of these other things that we're talking about. You know, partly age just reflects immaturity in these other areas. And I tell you what, I've met some 19 and 20-year-olds that are a whole lot more mature than many of the 25 and 30-year-olds that I know. And so I think that's a much better indicator of am I ready than age. But age is still a factor to be considered. Who I marry is also important. Spouse selection should not be underestimated either. Our focus should be on how do I know when I'm ready. But, you know, who I marry, making a wise marriage choice, that also is something that some effort needs to be exerted in, some thought, some wisdom needs to be exerted. You know, for one, you can apply these same guidelines that I was just talking about, the ones that I can apply to me. You can also turn and apply those to a prospective spouse. This is just kind of a short version of all those. Has this person learned to practice sexual self-control? Have they developed successful relationships? Man, it's a concern. For example, ladies, if your guy is not close to anybody else in his life but you, and maybe another girl or two, that's a real problem. Don't just think, well, I just understand him better, and he can relate to me, and I'm sure it'll be that way once we get married. No way. Once you get married, you're going to become like all the other guys in his life as far as relating goes. You're looking for people that are saying, man, I just feel really loved by that person. That's a good sign. That's the good kind of gossip you want to hear. Developing a ministry, their job, their finances, emotional stability. Faithful even through suffering. That was some advice that I got as a single is, look for a girl that is not just a Christian, but has held to her faith in spite of some really difficult, painful suffering. And there you know, this is not just somebody that's in it for when it's easy. But this is somebody that's with God, no matter how hard it gets. This person is sold out. And you're going to benefit from the, as they went through that suffering, they're going to become more and more sanctified. So you're going to be able to benefit from that as well. But, you know, you're just trying to look, you know, is this person really spiritual? is this person really, is this really a spiritual person? And if they've got a life-giving relationship with God, that's going to bode real well for your marriage. This question of being unequally yoked often comes up when we talk about this. And this is based on a passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, where Apostle Paul writes, "Do not be bound together with unbelievers or unequally yoked." This is the idea that you don't want to take an ox and a donkey and put them in the same yoke. It's a big wooden thing that fit over both their necks and get them to plow a field, because the one was taller and more powerful than the other. And so they're basically pulling at different rates. And instead of the two becoming stronger together, they actually destroy one another. And it doesn't do any good. They're pulling at different rates and in different directions, maybe. He says, "Don't be bound together with unbelievers. What partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? Fellowship with has light and darkness? What harmony has Christ with Belial? What has a believer in common with an unbeliever?" And so we got to ask a few questions about what does this mean, being unequally yoked. One, is it a sin for a Christian to marry a non-Christian? And the answer to that is yes, according to the Bible. Passages like this one right here is probably the clearest. Christians, God says, if you're a believer, don't marry an unbeliever. Is this because God wants to keep you from being happy, like some people in this situation tend to feel? No, it's not. This is because God wants to spare you almost certain immense pain. People, they get into these relationships and they think that, well, I'm sure that he'll change. I'm sure she'll change once we're married. Almost never the case. Occasionally it'll work out, but you know, for every one that does, there's maybe a dozen or more that don't, probably more than that. And that's incredibly painful. You basically, you've got these different value systems colliding, and it can be incredibly frustrating and painful to the spouse who's a believer, and it's not real pleasant for the spouse who's not a Christian either. It's unequally yoked. If they claim to be a Christian, what I would say is, sometimes they're like, well, you know, he says he's a Christian. She says she's a Christian. Back off. And, to that I would say, like James does, you're showing me your faith by your words. I show you my faith by what I do, by the way I live my life. I would not risk getting into a marriage like this, especially if you've got doubt that they're even a Christian. So is it a sin for a Christian to marry a non-Christian? Yes. What about this question here? Is it a sin for a Christian to date a non-Christian? Does that fall into the same category? Some Christians would say yes. I would definitely say no. I do not think it's a sin for a Christian to date a non-Christian. You know, I guess it's kind of a judgment call on what it means to be yoked. It seems like he's talking about a permanent, significant bond that you'd be making with one another. And dating is just not that. You know, dating, we can date today and we can be broken up tomorrow. It's pretty easy to get out of. It's kind of like a little bit more committed friendship. It's really like, if I don't want to be in this relationship anymore, I'll let you know. Is basically the level of commitment that you've got in dating. Sometimes you don't even get that from the person. But is it a sin to date a non-Christian? No. But it's risky and foolish to put yourself in this position. I never even considered anything like this. I don't know why you would. I guess technically it's okay, but you start forming these bonds with the other person. Part of the problem is that you've got different value systems colliding here, where the non-Christian is not going to share the biblical view on sex, and you wouldn't expect them to. They're going to be pushing the limits there. They're going to be upset about where you want to spend your time. Why would you spend your time investing in spiritual things? There's going to be a whole spiritual aspect of the relationship that is shut off. And I think it's foolish, and I strongly recommend against it. What about this question here? Unequally yoked. What if one partner is far more spiritually mature than the other one? Some people will be like, you can't marry that person because you're a lot more mature than them. Okay? Again, this is not a sin for a mature believer to marry a young believer or something like that, or a believer that's just not as, spiritually is just not as powerful as the other one. it might work out well. You know, you might have a case where the mature believer leads the less mature believer along. I think this is especially the case, and, you know, maybe the person hasn't been a Christian for that long, but yet they've been going, you know, full bore the whole time. I have shown tremendous willingness, and, you know, the rest of the body of Christ is really excited about this person as well, bearing witness. So it might work out well, but unfortunately, experience says that this often goes the other way. When the really mature believer marries the basically immature, spiritually immature, unspiritual believer, a lot of times it just creates a real tension in the relationship. You know, again, you're becoming one flesh with this person. You're linking yourself to this person. And so you've got to be in agreement on where are we going to spend our money? Where are we going to spend our time? What are our values? What are we going to build this family around? How are we going to raise our kids? What's the most important thing here? And unless, you know, both of you can affirm the most important thing is the things of God, you're going to have to end up compromising more often than not. And so often this does go the other way. What you got to remember here as you're considering is this person, would they be a good spouse? You got to remember, for one, everyone has potential. You might look at someone and say, yeah, they're not doing much spiritually, but they've just got so much potential. If only you knew them the way that I do, you would see the potential that they have. I tell you what, you could say that about anyone. You can say anyone, no matter whether they're a Christian or not, they've got potential. But if you're going to link yourself to this other person for the rest of your lives, I hope there's also some action. Because, you know, the best indicator of future behavior is past behavior. We're looking for somebody that's not just potentially good, but somebody that is really following God. Somebody that really has demonstrated that they're into spiritual growth. I hope that's what you're looking for, if that's something that's important to you. And that you're not deceiving yourself into thinking that all this potential is going to somehow finally, when I marry them, like I'm some sort of savior. That's what it is some of the time, is it's this Messiah complex on behalf of the more spiritual one that they can save this person. Here's the thing that somebody pointed out to me. You can't marry someone for what you hope they will become. You got to think to yourself, if this person never changes with all their strengths and weaknesses, am I going to be really happy, or am I going to be profoundly disappointed? And if the answer is the latter, then that should raise a flag. You know, nobody's going to be perfect in all these areas that I've been talking about. You know, that list of questions, you know, nobody's perfect. And you're gonna have issues in those to some degree, and so is your partner. But, you know, it's kind of it's a wisdom thing, you know. It's not necessarily a black and white issue. It's a wisdom issue. Is this a wise move? Is this a good move or not? Boy, so much we could talk about here. Breaking up, it's okay. I actually kind of had a problem with this. I thought, you know, under the agape model, if I'm totally sacrificially committed to this other person, no matter what I get out of it, I kind of had like a theological problem with under what circumstances would it be okay to break up? And, you know, one thing I had to note was that, you know, God does call us to love everyone with agape love, but he doesn't call us to marry everyone. It actually says, you know, a good spouse, a good wife, it's a pretty hard thing to find. And it's worth looking for. You know, it's okay to be in a relationship and to break up. Hopefully you haven't ripped the other person off while you were dating. You should expect it to be painful. And try not to draw it out, you know. Breaking up is kind of like ripping a Band-Aid off. Or it's like you can rip it off really slow, one hair at a time. Blink, blink, blink. And draw it out as long as you want to. Or you can just rip it off. And I suppose the metaphor doesn't fully translate over to breaking up. But, you know, there's some truth to, you know, instead of drawing it out for, you know, eight conversations about what this breakup's going to look like, I think it should be clear. Don't draw it out. Don't think it's going to be easy. This is part of why it's hard to break up, is because you break up and there's all this pain and stuff. And it can be pretty hard. It could take quite a bit of time for that pain to dissipate. And, you know, depending on how the relationship was, that person could be running through your mind for years to come in some form or another. You should expect the relationship to end. Statistically, the majority of dating relationships will not progress on to marriage. And so you should think to yourself, you know, when this relationship ends, what's it going to be like between me and this brother or between me and this sister? I think that's a wise way to approach our dating relationships. Whew. All right, preparing for marriage. What about succeeding in marriage? Boy, man, I wish we had another couple hours to talk about this. Couple points. I'm going to have to just skip some points here. Biblical marriage is always closely connected with Christian community. Marriages take place in the context of Christian community, if you read your Bible. There's no such thing as just this little married couple off by themselves doing their own thing. It's always part of, it's kind of orbiting and intermingling with the larger, what the Bible calls, body of Christ. And so in healthy marriages, both spouses are often more effective married than when they were single. It's like a joy to have a godly married couple in your home church, even if everybody's singles, you know, because they're even better together than they were when they were single. Another advantage here, too, is it gives you somewhere to turn when you need help in your marriage. I know there's definitely many times where I feel like I've been at an impasse with my wife, and I've either had to go and meet with and talk with a wise spiritual friend about it, or I've actually had to call this person in to meet with me and my wife to talk about the issues that we're having. And I'm convinced that we would be in major trouble if we didn't have that kind of help going on. You know, in fact, we've actually launched a program within the last couple of years, a marriage mentoring program, where we try to hook up newlywed couples or couples that have only been married a couple of years with married couples that have been married for quite some time kind of know a little bit more which ends up in marriage and can help mentor these younger couples along, because it's a big adjustment getting into marriage. The biggest problem we see in marriage is... I think the biggest problem we see in this group is couples that get married and then they just kind of withdraw from the rest of the group. There's the occasional couple that tries to cover up their issues with one another by ministering and by engaging with other people. But I think the bigger problem is couples just withdrawing, and just their marriage becomes more and more this private thing. They become more and more an outsider in the group. They don't understand that they're going to have to work. They're going to have to exert effort to, integrate themselves with the life of the Christian community. Common marriage destroyers. We just have to move through these a little quickly. Pride. Man, not humble enough to admit our faults. We can't resolve our conflicts. We're very careful that we're never the loser in any fight. How surprising when we read that love is not boastful or proud. Agape love is not that way. Control issues. It goes along with the expectations point. We've just got all these expectations, and we just set on this plan to change our mate into the person we want them to be. This applies in dating as well. You see this. We want to change our spouse. We never succeed. Part of the problem is it's wrong-headed. We're thinking they're the one that needs to change, when really I'm the one that needs to change. No amount of power tactics or punishment or manipulation are going to work. They can sense that. We got to accept the fact that the only one I can change is me. And you'll be surprised that when you change, your spouse might change some, but what changes more is your ability to accept the person. Final one we see here is lack of grace. We're so shocked that our partner would let us down. They hurt my feelings. They disappoint me. They behave wrongly. What am I supposed to do when my partner does these things? Well, we need to remember 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Love is not irritable, and it keeps no record of when it's been wrong. We need to forgive the person, and we need to practice some gratitude. You know, one approach I've heard for troubled couples is your homework is every day for the next week. You need to spend some time getting before God and making a list of the positive qualities in your mate and thanking God for those. And it's amazing the way that changes the person's perspective on the marriage. What's interesting, too, is oftentimes the thing that drew them to the person in the first place is also the thing that they can't stand about them now. It's like they just love that this was such a strong, independent man, And now I'm just so mad that he won't sit on the couch and talk about my feelings for 2 hours. And it's like, honey, you didn't marry that kind of guy, okay? And we need to replace these with healthy alternatives. Like, instead of have all these expectations, we need to learn to be easy to please. Instead of our pride, we need to instead turn the tables and go for the humility route. The first one to admit that I'm wrong. To serve the other person. Self-control, instead of trying to control the other person, I need to realize that maybe I should learn some self-control and work on my own spiritual growth. And instead of the lack of grace, we replace this with forgiveness, acceptance, and gratitude, all of which flow out of our relationship with God and are only possible in the truest and deepest sense in a relationship with God. So, application for the married. Center your family around God. Learn to be a love giver. Most of us here aren't married, but that's kind of a vision that we're looking for here for our marriages, hopefully, those of us that end up getting married. For the unmarried, however, the application, I would say a couple of things. One, you need to view being single as a gift from God. So many of us, we sit around just thinking over and over, I can't believe I'm still single. How long is it going to be till I'm married? We meet a girl for the first time. We're like, ooh, could she be the one? Our mind starts going crazy. We think again and again how incomplete I am and how just I can't be happy unless I'm married. And then we get married and we realize that we wasted our whole time being single, wishing that we were married. And that's a time you're not going to get back again. You know, I love my marriage. But my wife and I were both so glad that we spent quite a few years single, enjoying it, building relationships, having memories that we will never forget. It was awesome. And, both of us got a lot of spiritual growth during that time that we both appreciated later in marriage. I remember I played soccer back in high school, and there was one summer where I didn't really do my conditioning like I should have. And then 3-a-days hit there in mid-August. And I had trouble walking for several weeks because, my conditioning wasn't up where it should have been. And we don't want to make that same mistake in marriage where, there's things we could be doing now that are going to help us to enjoy and appreciate marriage instead of being unable to walk for several weeks like I was. So we need to take advantage of our single time and see that as a gift from God and enjoy it. Learn to serve God. Try to figure out the place he's got for you, the works he has stored up for you to do. And appreciate this time. 2, don't take matters into your own hands. It's tempting to want to just cast aside what God says about marriage and to do things the way that I feel like doing it. I'm telling you, you got to believe that God is good. That's what this comes down to for a lot of us. Is God good? Do I trust him? And am I willing to wait and believe that he's got something good stored up for me here, whatever that might be? So don't just pull the lever and eject and take things into your own hands. And finally, we need to look for a God-centered marriage. And, this is one where, we're keeping our eyes peeled. We're listening for positive gossip for members of the opposite sex. Hopefully, we're trying to do some casual dating without even any romantic interest, but just trying to build friendships with members of the opposite sex. So we're kind of keeping our eyes peeled. And at the same time, we're pursuing God and pursuing our spiritual growth. One of the best pieces of advice I got was, when it comes to dating, what you should do is run as fast as you can toward God and then periodically stop and look around and see if there's anybody running with you. And, if you follow that advice, there might not be anybody there. Just keep on going. And you might be surprised one of these times you stop and look around and there's somebody right there next to you. And you might be a little bit surprised as to who that person is. I know that was the case with me and my wife, which, for us, it was kind of a, if you think about that spiritual, personal, physical, for us, we were friends for years, without any attraction to one another at all. It really was as our spiritual life grew that, we started leading this group together and we started spending time together, trying to support each other and talk about the ministry that we were doing. And as that happened, you know, this friendship began to grow. We found we liked spending time with each other. Still, you know, neither of us were romantically interested in the other one. And, you know, it wasn't until somewhere near the end of our pre-marriage relationship that we started to realize that we really liked each other and were really attracted to one another. And it didn't take long for the rest of the personal and physical to catch up with that foundation that had been laid. And so I just, you know, I can't emphasize enough the importance of doing this God's way. You know, for everybody, relationships are best when we do this God's way. Don't take things into your own hands and go based on your own wisdom. You got to listen to God. You got to follow Him. You got to trust that He's good. And ultimately, you got to start with the relationship with God. This is where you begin to experience the love of God, and this is where everything flows out of. Yeah, Lord, thanks so much for your grace. Thank you that even though we've done our best to mess things up in our own lives, that you love us, that you came, that you died for us, and that you want to bring your healing power, the power of love, Lord, to bear in our lives. You want to teach us how to have healthy relationships. You want to teach us how to love like you, God. And I pray that we would be willing to learn to sit under your teaching, Lord. That we would want to become more and more like you and learn to love like you. And I pray that we can take sacrificial love, Lord, this other-centeredness, and bring it into every part of our lives. I pray if there's some of us here that have never experienced your love, that tonight might be the night. Or we finally encounter you for the first time, Lord, and see the power of your love. And I pray for those of us that do know your love, Lord, that we would seek to apply this in maybe a dating relationship or marriage, or that we would just start applying it in our relationships with our friends and make the most of this time we've got now before we're married. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.